Blog Talk Radio.
The Rebecca Roth Show, where the light shines out of the darkness onto the elephant in the room.
Welcome once again to the Rebecca Roth Show. I'm Ramjet, your host, and we're excited to bring you another fun-filled, fact-filled show. We've gotten some great comments from last week's show when we talked about the in-depth analysis of Flight 11 phone calls. And we're kind of going to continue with that series as we now go into Flight 175. And so without further ado, I bring you Miss Rebecca Roth.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me on the Rebecca Roth Show. Ramjet,
it's my pleasure. So hard to do.
Hey, I know that I kind of had a feeling that this is what everybody's been wanting me to do since the first book was released. Could you just do a show and not have any host really interrupt you and talk about these phone calls? And
does that mean I have to shut up?
Yeah, that would be your cue. And what I saw and heard and how things were unfolding as a flight attendant, as I started to research after I found out that a half a dozen of the hijackers were still alive, and I started to look at this because I'd never really looked at the entire event. So, you know, somewhere 2008 or 9, I started really, well, once that's when I found out the hijackers were still alive, I thought, well, I got to look at this because something's wrong because there's no way anybody lived through those crashes. We all know this. What we thought we saw. And so when I started looking at it, then I started doing these phone calls. So if you haven't already listened, I'm just going to suggest that you listen to the show called The Common Hijack Strategy, because that'll help you understand what we should have been doing and what the flight attendants should have been doing and where they should have called. And I'll be referencing those, the common strategy. That was the FAA hijacking strategy. And also, the last show we did was the phone calls from Flight 11, the two flight attendants, Betty Ong and Amy Sweeney, and how I saw the FBI delete things, how I saw things that made no sense if they were in the air, if they were pressurized, and things that could only make sense if they were on the ground and not pressurized. So as I started putting these things together, I took the planes step by step from when Flight 11 took off the second flight, United 175. Now, this is really interesting. Before I forget, has nothing to do with the phone calls, but on this particular flight, we have an eyewitness that watched this aircraft go in for a landing in Western Massachusetts. And she contacted me right before I finished writing The Methodical Deception, the second book. She knows what she saw. And actually, the plane was so close to the ground, she swears she could see people's faces, and one face in particular was a dark-haired gentleman. Now, she would have been seeing the left side of the aircraft. It was headed to the north from her. And so we're going to talk about a gentleman, because on that particular flight, United 175, there were two people that called out. Just like the last plane was two flight attendants, this one's two passengers. It's kind of almost starts to look like a code to flight attendants, the next plane two passengers. The third plane was one of each. Okay.
Well, question. You know, I remember when you were first, you know, analyzing Flight 11 and those phone calls and stuff, and I think your response afterwards was, you know, that was a little weird. You know, that there's something wrong there.
Yeah.
And but you weren't ready to dive right in and say, okay, you know, the 9/11 story, official story, is completely bunk. But then you started into Flight 175, and you started to see some of the same kinds of weirdness transpire, and just one thing built onto another, and pretty soon, you know, the Rebecca Roth legend was created.
Yeah, wild. So, okay, well, at this point, and by the time I'm looking at these phone calls from these two passengers, mind you, I'm now sitting with FAA documentation, the National Transportation Safety Board documentation, and everything I could get on what they claim, the government officials. And this is who we always trust with our lives. So I was a bit in shock when I was looking at this. But I'm looking at what the FAA and the NTSB are saying that the aircraft is doing, the altitude, what's happening around the aircraft, is it descending, what altitude is it at, when all of these phone calls start, and what could have been going on, and what should have been going on, and what you would have said if you were a passenger. So what I want to do first is I'm going to talk about Peter Hansen. Peter Hansen was on a gentleman traveling with his wife and daughter, and Peter Hansen called out from Flight 175 United at around 8:52, according to the government's information, and he called his father. And he called his father, and he told his father... I have now. This is from the FBI report dated 9/11/2001. Because I'm going to read a few things from Peter Hansen, so you can see how the story changed a little bit as time went on. So his dad says he calls him sometime before 9 o'clock, but the other official story tells you that his first phone call to his father was at 8:52. I believe it was 8:52. So he tells his father that his plane has been hijacked, and he says, quote, "I think they've taken over the cockpit. An attendant has been stabbed, and someone else up front may be killed. The plane is making strange moves. Call United Airlines and tell them this is Flight 175, Boston to L.A. Now, the thing that I find interesting about that is that really... the official other stories that I've read is that Peter Hansen actually calls out and he tells his dad that airline hostess has been stabbed. But he may say that again, actually, later in this FBI thing. So then his dad says that Peter was talking in a low tone, but he wasn't whispering. And he believed that Peter was calling him from his cell phone. Keep that in mind. At 8:52. Okay. So then he calls back. His dad calls the local police department in Easton, which is the town he lives in, and he tells them about the call that he just got from his son. Now, about 6-7 minutes later, at 9 o'clock, now this is 3 minutes before supposed impact into the South Tower, Peter calls his dad back, and this time he says a stewardess has been stabbed, and they seem to have knives and mace. They said they have a bomb. For some reason, we're expected to believe hijackers that could barely speak English would go back to row 31 near the very tail section of that aircraft and tell this man what their plans are. He says that the people sitting around him are all getting sick from whatever it is they sprayed. The plane is making jerky movements, and I don't think the pilot's flying the plane. I think we're going down. I think they, the hijackers, intend to go to Chicago or someplace and fly into a building. Now think about that. Prior to 9/11, no one would have ever thought that scenario. Condoleezza Rice and George Bush didn't think that would ever happen. They are on record numerous times saying, we never dreamed that an aircraft could be used as a weapon of mass destruction. Well, we never heard of such a thing. We know that's a lie, but we remember them saying this, right?
Well, the thing that just stood out to me in what you said was, is that he says, I don't think the pilots are flying the plane.
Right, and remember where he's sitting? Row 31, about 150 feet from the cockpit.
Why would you ever say that? I mean, what would make you think that unless you were trying to tell a story that wasn't necessarily true?
Exactly. Now, there's some interesting things about Peter Hansen. There's a couple more things. I've got a notepads here about him. Well, now, from the History Commons or the Terror Timeline, which kind of changes a little bit, and sometimes this is FBI being quoted, sometimes it's the media being quoted, But his dad said he called from his cell phone. Now, I just happened to look at an FAA when I saw this, at an FAA document that had that aircraft at 28,000 feet at that time. How is that happening? Nobody's calling from their cell phone at above 1,800 feet. Nobody's calling from 25,000 or 28,000, even if they were descending, right? So we know that can't be right, but he probably had caller ID that said Peter's cell phone, just like other people did who got phone calls from cell phones from people. So, and he tells them that he thinks the hijackers have a bomb. Remember, Amy Sweeney said that same thing. Okay, so then Peter, okay, go ahead.
I was going to say, well, not only did she say the same thing, but the same kind of scenario was playing out. Somebody was stabbed. Maybe somebody else was killed. They have a bomb. I think we're being hijacked.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Have I heard that before?
So we're starting
that was
to
last
see.
Last week.
We're starting to see the same information that's being dispersed by these the passengers now, or the phone callers. Let's just call them phone callers because they're kind of all the same. So now, as the story goes, Peter Hansen's father. Now, keep in mind, the second call came in at 9 o'clock. At 9:03, we saw an aircraft going into the South Tower. If they were the same, what are the chances that his dad, after he'd already talked to the police once, instead of calling the police again, goes and turns on his television just in time to see a hijacked plane fly in like a hot knife through butter to the South Tower? And so he just, you know, was, oh my goodness. Well, the interesting thing about Peter Hansen's story that I found is this is one of the first times that the FBI includes, except for Daniel Lewin, 9B. Now, when I referenced the FBI case number, for those of you who like to look things up or the trolls, I'm going to repeat that case number for you because you're going to find all of this information. These are a bunch of phone call documents from the FBI. The one I'm reading is dated 9/11/2001, and the number, the case number, is 265D as in David, hyphen N as in Nancy, Y as in Yankee, hyphen 280350. This is the Peter Hansen story. So what it goes on to say is something that kind of grabs your emotions. This is the most unusual one is Daniel Lewin, because they talk all about his mother, how she's a doctor in Israel, what brand of shoes and watch, and how he was manicured. But for Peter Hansen, it goes on to say that Peter Hansen is employed as a vice president of marketing at a company called TimeTrade.com. When I first looked at this, it grabbed my emotions and it tricked me just like it did everyone else. And it says here from Newton, Massachusetts, but it's really Waltham, Massachusetts, and they're relatively close together. So he's with a company called TimeTrade.com. TimeTrade of Waltham, Massachusetts, it's referred to. He graduated from Northeastern University in Boston. Not that that matters to us or the 9/11 story at all. He had a bachelor's in science and a degree in business administration, and he attended a master's degree, attained a master's degree in business administration from Boston University. Not that that has anything to do with United 175, but it gets you kind of getting to know Peter a little bit, doesn't it? Okay, we're getting warm and fuzzy with Peter. And Mr. Hansen was traveling to Los Angeles, California to attend a business meeting and was accompanied on his flight by his wife, Korean-American Sue Kim Hansen. Now, gives her birth date. She's believed to be 38 years old. I'm assuming they're getting this from Peter's father because this was a live interview they did with him. She's a female. And she is a first-generation Korean. She's 5'3". She weighs 135 pounds. I don't know how her father-in-law would know this. Honestly, I don't. And their daughter, their one and only child, get your hankies out now, because this is when they really started to build the emotion of the 9/11. Christine Hansen, she was born in the year 1999. It was her very first airplane trip as a family. And they were going to take their daughter after his business trip to visit Sue's grandparents, because her parents had deceased, and they'd never met their granddaughter before, and then they were going to take her to Disneyland. Okay, you sniffing yet? That's such a sad story. Honest to God, I was bawling when I first read this. And then it goes on to say some other things that have nothing absolutely to do with 9/11 or these people. I mean, really. Let's see. They apparently had told the father-in-law that they were excited about going on their very first trip together and indicated that they intended to obtain seating at a bulkhead seat so that their little daughter, she was around 2 or 3, could play in front of the bulkhead on the floor. It was something flight attendants absolutely hated. So he's not certain where they were seated on the flight. This is the father-in-law. But Sue Kim Hansen, she wears corrective eyeglasses and has an antique wedding ring, just like her husband Peter's. Now, I'm not sure where this fits into the 9/11 story, and why would the FBI be even taking notes on this? But Peter and her had these sort of matching family heirloom wedding rings. Don't think they were ever found either. And Peter's, now his may have been repaired because of resizing, it says. I'm not kidding you. This is the FBI report. Now, the father, Peter Hansen's father, provided the interviewing FBI agents with a color photo portrait of the family, Peter, Sue, and their little girl. And they took a picture of it. They took a digital picture of this family portrait. The father-in-law indicated that after receiving the calls from Peter, that he then turned on the television to see whether or not the hijacking was being reported on to the television. And he noted that he began watching exactly at just in time to see the live footage of the second airliner crashing into the World Trade Center. Now, here's the problem with that story. Well, at 8:55, that airplane had two near misses. It almost hit a Delta plane, according to the official story, and a U.S. Airways plane. They actually did a diversion, a visionary, had to, you know, fly the aircraft in a manner that you would know that they were trying not to hit somebody or something. So it's pretty disruptive when that happens. Well, flight attendants end up on the floor, the ceiling, the meal carts, beverage carts. It's quite a mess, and so do the passengers. Something that if it happened to you 5 minutes earlier, you would mention to your father. We just had a near miss, because another thing that happens when you go real close. Now, according to the official story, the airplane was about 200 feet away from their aircraft. If you get an airplane that's coming, crossing you, above you, under you, near you by 200 feet, you're going to feel jet wash. Remember, there was an American airplane crash out of JFK that got too close to 747 jet wash and supposedly came out of the sky in New York. Not long after 9/11, November. We've talked about that before.
Also, this near miss occurred at about 28,000 feet.
That's correct. And so here you are. You're in this near miss with two airplanes within a five-minute period. And in that period of time, you had just spoken to your dad, and then you are just about to phone him again, and you never mention, I mean, the airplane flying erratic is not what he would have said. You would have known it. You'd have heard the jet. You would have felt it had been scary. Let's just put it to you that way. And so I found that was really interesting. But when I started to look, once I stopped, you know, my tissues and thinking, oh, my God, this poor little girl, her first trip to Disneyland, and oh, my gosh. When I started to look at Peter Hansen, he's actually the vice president of sales for one of the largest military-industrial complex contracting companies, timetrade.com. You can look it up, Waltham, Massachusetts. I won't go into it. But I thought that was kind of unusual and kind of one of those coinkydinks that I don't believe in anymore, because I found so many coincidences in this 9/11 stuff that I just stopped believing in them. There is no such thing as a coincidence. The next person, by the way, Peter Hansen was seated at H, J, and K on the right side. This is a double aisle 767, double aisle aircraft. So he's looking out the window, And according to the charts that I have from the FAA and the National Transportation Safety Board and NORAD, oh, I had lots of them on this one. This is where all of a sudden I went, uh-oh. Now I know why Thomas Keene was questioning the FAA and the Pentagon, by the way. NORAD, Pentagon, same military. Okay, so they're located right now, according to the documents, somewhere between 5 and 10,000 feet elevation at 9 o'clock, directly over the Hudson River. On the left side of the aircraft is a perfect view of Newark International Airport, the Hudson River, the Newark Bay, and Peter Hansen sitting on the right side of the aircraft, off the right-hand side of the aircraft. Ladies and gentlemen, you'll see a perfect view of the Statue of Liberty with Manhattan in the background. Peter Hansen thinks they're going to fly him to Chicago. Now, if you're 5,000 feet, the FAA says one and the NORAD says another, so there's a couple different altitudes. Let's just say 5,000 feet above the Hudson River. That's not very high. You can almost take a hot air balloon up that high, right?
But if 5 minutes earlier they were at 28,000 mm-hmm. feet, that means they descended 23,000 feet in 5 minutes.
That's right.
During which time he was on the phone and he never mentioned
never mentioned a nosedive? Yeah, neither one of them mentioned that. So I kept going back over this, looking and redoing the math, because I'm like, why? If you were on that plane and you were on the phone and you just had two near misses and you had to do some evasive flying and you were on a rapid descent from 28,000 feet down to 5,000 feet.
Why in the hell would you think you were near Chicago?
Why would you think you were going to continue to Chicago? Why wouldn't you be saying, we're probably landing in I would say, LaGuardia. It could have been saying, maybe we're going to land in Newark. It's right outside the other side of the aircraft. But what's really interesting, not only did neither one of these guys mention the fact that they were on this rapid descent and had just practically hit two other aircraft within, you know, moments before these phone calls. But the other guy that called out, lo and behold, according to the government documents and their story, he was at row 31 too, only he was in seat A, B, and C over there. He had A and B. Window seat and the next seat. I guess, you know, I don't know why, but they claimed he was in A and B. 31, row 31. That's near the end. Now, some of those aircraft may be, depending upon the configuration, may have 35, 36, 37 rows, but they're way back near the end, way back by the tail. But if you're sitting there on the left side of the aircraft looking out the window, 5,000 feet above Newark, and you're a pilot like this passenger, Brian Sweeney. Now, Brian Sweeney, he did something really, really, really strange. He calls out to his wife, who's a school teacher, at 9 o'clock. And he calls their home. Well, why would you call your wife? Whoops, sorry, I dropped my book. Why would you call your wife at home when you know she's at work? He leaves a message. On their home recorder, he leaves a message and tells her that things are not looking good. He's been hijacked.
Well, you would do that if you wanted to leave a message.
He's not the only husband that maybe didn't want to talk to his wife. You get me? Yeah. You know, some wives can tell when their husbands are lying on the phone, right?
Yeah, but he needed a message to facilitate the story.
Yeah. So he leaves a message on the home recorder at around the same 8:52 he calls his wife. And he says, leaves a message on her phone at home recorder. We've been hijacked, and it doesn't look good. And then he calls his mother at 9 o'clock. And he tells her what's happening on board. And they have quite a little discussion about his favorite TV show, was something about angels and stuff. So I forgot the name of it now. Let's see if that's in this note here from the FBI. So let me just read this to you because it's kind of interesting. It's kind of hard because a lot of it's blanked out. But Brian At the time, she noticed the clock on her kitchen said 8:58 when the phone rang. Her conversation with Brian was mostly personal. However, with regard to the hijackers, Brian Sweeney told her that I don't know who they are. In the FBI and other things that have come out, he never mentions hijackers, actually. But he says he doesn't know who they are. And he also said that the plane's passengers at 9 o'clock were thinking about doing something like, quote, storming the cockpit. And he believed that the plane was flying somewhere over Ohio. Now, let me repeat to you where this airplane supposed to have been at 9 o'clock, directly over the Hudson River, Newark Bay, Newark International, the Statue of Liberty, with Manhattan off the right-hand side of the aircraft. Why would a pilot, this guy is a pilot, why would a pilot think that he is over Ohio? Remember all that talk about Cleveland? I went there too. So a lot of people, what about the planes being switched to Cleveland? Okay, well, are we starting to see something interesting about these two people that called in?
So how long had that plane been in the air from the time it left Boston at 9 o'clock?
It left Boston at 8:14.
So it had been in the air
about 45 minutes.
Less than an hour.
Mm-hmm.
It couldn't be anywhere close to Cleveland in 45
yes,
minutes.
Yes, that's true.
And a pilot would know that.
Yes, he would. Now, so, you know, and I talked about this in my earlier interviews for the first book, because I really actually uncovered this after Methodical Illusion was printed. And so I just kept looking at these people because I kept, every time I'd look, it was like another layer opened up. Well, Brian Sweeney, interestingly enough, he was 6 foot two, 225 pounds. He was a United States Navy flight instructor. He flew the F-14 in the 1991 Gulf War. He worked for, most of the stuff you read about him was he was a contractor. And then I found that one CNN report, I think it was, said he worked for a company called Brandeis Associates as a Department of Defense contractor. But then when I found his obituaries, I found an obituary from someone that lovingly said, Brian, I miss you and I remember you from the M, as in the letter, cafeteria when we both worked at MITRE, the shadow government that we all know about now. We don't. You better read Methodical Illusion. When we both worked at MITRE, right before 9/11. And so I read it again. I made a screenshot of it because I thought, well, that's the kind of stuff that could go away. Here he is, 6 foot two, 225 pounds. Now, the guys at Miramar that were in his flight training classes and that hung out with him in San Diego said that Brian Sweeney could kill any human being with his bare hands. Why do you think he sat in his seat calling his mommy? Do you think he was on the plane? Do you think the plane was really there? None of this makes any sense. So when you listen to this, also, his mother told the FBI that there was absolutely no background noise on his phone call. But you got to know this. I got an email from Brian Sweeney's pilot's wife. Yeah, I'm going to hear me that. I thought Brian's mom said he was a pilot. Says right here he was a pilot. He was an F-14 pilot for the United States military, according to his mother. But this gal tells me Brian Sweeney wasn't a pilot. He was what's called a radar intercepting officer, RIO. Her husband was actually his pilot on the front seat. He sat in the back. So he was working for MITRE as a radar specialist, and how handy would that be when you want to make an airplane look like it disappears? Really handy. If I were planning it, I'd plan to have Brian Sweeney there with all of his talents. Like, I mean, I read this again. I was like, I don't believe this. But his mom was like, what? There was no background noise on the phone call. Well, if you've ever heard anybody calling you from an airplane, even if it's taxiing, and you know how, listen, if you don't know, you go to the bathroom and take a tinkle with your cell phone on talking to somebody and let them hear it. Because the microphones on a cell phone pick up everything. If you get my drift, every little thing. Okay, so we've got Brian Sweeney calling his mom 3 minutes before, but here's the key factor. He says to his mother, a bunch of us passengers, mind you, there weren't very many people around him, and Peter Hansen, who was on the phone at the same time to his dad, clear across the aisle at 3HJK, neither one of them ever mentioned the descent. Neither one of them, and this guy's a pilot. He would know evasive flying when he was experiencing it. He would know jet wash when he was experiencing it, trust me. Neither one of them mentioned it on their phone calls. And when I put all of this together on Flight 175, all of a sudden, I went, neither one of these guys were on the airplane. That airplane wasn't even there. Because they surely would have mentioned a frightening descent. They surely would have mentioned their aircraft. If this is a wide-body 767, it's not a fighter jet. And you don't do evasive flying in these kind of airplanes without knowing about it when you're sitting in a seat, especially when you're a trained pilot. And plus, the other guy, Peter Hansen, now he was traveling all the time on business. He was the vice president of marketing and sales for Time Trade International of Waltham, Massachusetts. Well, you guys can do this because it's always fun to do a little bit of your own research. And I know we are lazy and everybody wants to hear me tell you. I don't have this particular note in front of me. But one of the things I found when I got to this point, I thought TimeTrade.com was a timeshare company. I thought this guy was like a semi-real estate agent selling timeshares in Honolulu or something. Well, when I looked it up, I found out that they're a huge contractor. After 9/11, they became a huge contract for the Department of Homeland Security and the DOD and the TSA and all of those wonderful newly formed security-conscious government entities that we saw pop up there with the Department of Homeland Security. And their government contracts went up like quadrupled right away. And they're still making tons of money through government contracts. I don't know where Peter is. I don't know what happened to Peter. But here's another thing that's really weird. Flight 175. This is the plane that I turned my television on, just like a lot of other people, just in time to see. Now, it hit the South Tower, supposedly, almost 15 minutes after something hit the North Tower that we're led to believe was Flight 11. But of all the pilots that contact me, and trust me, I get lots of pilots and flight attendants contact me. Everyone wants to know this. Two things. What was on the bottom of that plane? Because on the belly of the fuselage of that aircraft, when you look at it, it's even on the CNN footage, you can see something that's a pod or a bump. It doesn't fit. It's not right. It's not supposed to be on a commercial 767. Then the next question they ask me, have you ever figured out how they made it look like an aluminum aircraft slid through a steel, glass, and cement skyscraper like a hot knife through butter? Because that's impossible. You heard what I just said. Every pilot that has contacted me has asked me that, and they've said these words, because that is impossible. And every airline person that's dealing with reality will tell you that same thing. When I first saw it, I remember thinking that it was some kind of crazy War of the Worlds update, and it was some sort of trick photography, and I thought poorly done because it wasn't realistic. Now, you want to ask me what would happen if the airplane hit that building? It would explode on the outside. It's aluminum. Look at what happens. Just Google search some images for bird strike. Just take a look at what a bird will do to an aluminum aircraft. And they weren't going supersonic. We watched that airplane float in, maybe doing 200 miles an hour. We all got to see it in the TV, the part that they showed us, but there's footage out there where you see an explosion and you never, ever see an airplane. And that's just one camera. I don't know how they did this. I don't know how it all came about. But I've uncovered some pretty coincidental companies involved with people like Barbara Olson and the law firm she worked for, actually. We'll go into that later, too, when we talk about American 77. So, yeah, that's what everybody wants to know. How did they make it look Like that building, that airplane went through that building like a hot knife through butter. Well, I'd like to know this. How could any of us believe that Peter Hansen, traveling with his Korean wife and daughter, how could they be privy to the information of what a hijacker was going to be doing or had been doing? This aircraft supposedly was hijacked real close to the time that the first airplane supposedly hit the North Tower. So, and within moments, he knew that the plane was hijacked. I don't know whatever made him think the pilots weren't there. It's just like somebody told him to say that. But the better question is, how would Brian Sweeney know the scenario, the let's roll scenario, where the passengers are going to break FAA hijack protocol and take over in a hijacking? Because that wouldn't ever happen. You talk to any flight attendant and they'll tell you, we would never let that happen. You're not insured. You're not trained. You don't know what the code words are. So when Brian Sweeney said that he thinks that a group of passengers at 9 o'clock are going to take over the cockpit, this is the guy, remember, that the guys in Miramar that trained with him said that he could kill any human being with his bare hands. Well, why didn't he do something? All of the hijackers, by the way, were 5'6", 5'7", 5'8". I think one of them was 5'10". The rest of them were pretty small guys, around 120 to 145 pounds. So why would this guy, Brian Sweeney, who had been trained in survival and could really kill another human being with his bare hands, according to all the guys in San Diego at Miramar, why didn't he do anything? Well, chances are, let me just tell you, he wasn't on the plane. Well, that plane was on the ground in the hangar. Why do I know this? Because you can't make a cell phone call, which Brian Sweeney's were, according to his own mother, and it's in the FBI document. His wife also, Brian Sweeney, said she called from his cell. What did he do? He left a phone call message on their home recorder, and it said Brian's cell. Later on the next day, she said, well, I'm not sure how he called, actually. But she started backtracking, which a lot of people did, on these cell phones, because whoever the planners were, I don't think they realized, maybe they're used to flying on aircraft that have cell service or have better communication than what we had in 2001 from an aircraft. Because I'm here to tell you, I don't care if you had Verizon or GTE or who your airphones were with. I've talked to just about every airline that had them during that time, flight attendants from them and pilots. There was a bad flaw in the system. It was they were so poorly done, and the whole technology was so new that you could use one, maybe two phones at once on an aircraft. Now, we're talking this aircraft here. All four of these aircraft held around 200 people. 757s, maybe 180, 186, somewhere in there, and it depends on if there's one, two, or three classes of service. The 767, around 220, 100, maybe 230, depending on if it's a first class, business class, or just first and coach. So they vary up a little bit. But just to give you an idea, how many people, and we're going to talk about this later on, and Flight 93 were supposedly on the phone at once. And that's really fascinating because they were in a serious rapid descent. And again, no one mentioned they're descending. They're landing. They're going down. And they were basically in a serious emergency descent, much like what you'd see if you had a cabin decompression.
Well, you know, there are some theories, and I know that you and I have talked about this, that in this particular flight, Peter Hansen and Brian Sweeney may not have ever boarded Flight 175 as it flew for the eyewitness to see into Westover. They may have not even been on that plane, and they may have made these phone calls from some other location, being told or scripted exactly what to say at the exact right time. That's a possibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no proof of that, but when you look at how this whole story evolved and why they wouldn't know the common denominators mm-hmm. of a flight and how it how the
where
FAA,
they were,
where they were, and how the FAA described that it, you know, at 28,000 feet, tried to avoid a Delta flight,
And then a U.S. Air flight too.
You know, and their job was to tell the story, and they did it much better than Betty Ahn.
Yeah, well, that's true. They got some really good information out. But remember this: I know that people always ask me, "What do you think happened to the passengers when they all got into that hangar?" Peter Hansen, to me, told us, because he said that the passengers seated around him, they've sprayed pepper spray or mace or something. Again, just like Betty Ong said, they sprayed mace or something. He said they sprayed pepper spray or mace or something, and everyone seated around him was vomiting and getting sick, but he wasn't, and his wife and daughter weren't. He didn't tell his dad that, my kid's sick, my wife's sick, but the people sitting around him were getting sick.
And again, if the plane was pressurized, everyone would be getting sick.
He would have been nailed with it. His wife and his kid, obviously, his 3-year-old, I think she was 2 or 3, the little one would have felt it first, so he would have been tending to her and would have certainly told her grandfather that whatever it is they've sprayed has really affected little, I think her name was Christine. And nothing was mentioned about that. So when you start to look at this with open eyes, and honestly, I fell for this guy's story hook, line, and sinker. But when I got a phone call from Brian Sweeney's pilot's wife, or an email, and then I started to look and see that he was a radar specialist, man. This is somebody who could have been sitting with a laptop helping the aircraft look like it disappeared off radar, make sure it didn't come back. He also could have been a very handy person if he were on the getaway plane to get that plane out of the country. Because we're going to talk about that at the end of this scenario when we talk about the next book and stuff. But having a radar intercept officer, somebody that really knew about radar, who also is an employer for MITRE, and a defense contractor called Brandy's, he probably was very helpful to have. But you got to ask yourself, because, and the reason I say this, I'm going to bring it up again. Right after 9/11, when we started flying again, men would come to the front door, which I was usually standing at, and give me their seat number. Sometimes they'd just give me the corner of their boarding pass or whatever. And they would say, I'm military. I'm a firefighter. I'm a state police officer. I'm a judo trained. I'm a black belt. I'm just a big guy, and nobody's going to give you any SHIT. If they do, come to row 18B, because that's where I'll be. So here's my number. Don't forget me. And I can't tell you how many flight attendants, even just like recently I was chatting with someone, that said, yeah, you're right. That was human nature, man. Everybody after 9/11 would come up. So you got to ask yourself, when you got a guy that all of his buddies from Miramar, this is where the serious U.S. Navy fighter pilots train, and they hang out, and they all said, if you were ever in a bar fight, man, you want to have Brian Sweeney with you, because he could kill any human being with his bare hands. Why didn't he get up and take on a 5'6" hijacker that couldn't barely speak English? And that same guy back there at row 31 was somehow informing Peter Hansen that they were going to fly to Chicago. But how could Peter Hansen, a well-traveled businessman, not realize that at 5,000 feet they were landing somewhere in New York? And how could he not recognize the Statue of Liberty? There's only one answer to this. Neither one of them were on that plane where they claimed that plane was. Now keep in mind that one of the things also that happened, and we didn't see it very often, but you can still find it on YouTube, there are eyewitnesses from something that hit the South Tower that will tell you that was no commercial plane. There was no logo. There were no windows. The firefighters that were in the fireboat in the river that this plane flew right over called into dispatch, and they said it was a bomber-style military aircraft. Now, that's two firefighters from New York. You'd think they'd be able to tell you what an aircraft. Now, keep in mind, the aircraft was probably about 1,200 feet when it flew over them, because it had to be under 1,000 feet to hit the building where it did. I'm going to say that the South Tower might have been hit at roughly 800 feet. So you would think that two New York firefighters that kind of know their stuff could recognize, and I don't know, maybe they were military at one point, I don't know, I just didn't follow up on them. But I thought that was really interesting. They called into dispatch and said, that plane that hit the second tower was a bomber-style military airplane. It was not commercial. It was not commercial. And you can find that on YouTube and listen to it. It's pretty interesting. They had no reason to lie, by the way. And so, as I have no reason to lie, I'm just sharing with you what I uncovered. And as I uncovered this, I started putting things together. One of the things I started doing was every time someone said, we're in the air, or mace, or something, mace or something, and these kind of comments, I started to see the same comments, the same almost sentence structure being used. And that's how I realized that these people had to have been told that they were part of a hijacking drill and that this is the scenario, because you got to ask yourself this. How did Brian Sweeney know the scenario for the Let's Roll Flight 93 scenario? And he just told his mother, a bunch of us are thinking of taking back the cockpit. Now, this is the same guy who didn't mention anything or any description about any hijackers. He just thinks the plane had been hijacked. He doesn't know who's got it or anything. So why would he say that? Somebody told him the scenario of the day. Now, that's my guess.
A little later on, you got another witness. Was that Flight 11, you think?
Flight 77.
Oh, that was 77. Mm-hmm. Okay, coming. All right, so we'll
yep.
save that for
yep.
another day.
And we'll talk about that one the next show we do, the phone calls from Flight 77, because on that flight we had Barbara Olson, the TV commentator, Ted Olson's wife, the Solicitor General, and a flight attendant who called her parents.
You know, when you think about it, if you look at how these flights progressed, you know, you've got the flight attendants to lend mm-hmm. certitude and credibility mm-hmm. to what it is. Then you've got some passengers.
Two passengers.
And then you've got
one
people
of each.
Like Barbara Olson.
Who, one of each.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it just, but Barbara Olson, because of her unique mm-hmm. status as being the wife of a Solicitor General, I mean, that just absolutely is perfect for saying that this is exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And
it validifies the
story. Yeah, you got to believe me because,
yeah.
you know, I'm who I am.
And, you know, Barbara Olson is the only one that said they had knives and box cutters. She's the only one. Everyone else said bombs, guns, and, of course, almost every plane said pepper spray or mace or something like that, some type of gas. So when people ask me, what do you think happened? Huh? Well, I have to say this, and I think I laid this out pretty well in Methodical Illusion. And I think my characters realized that more than likely, once the people were taken off the plane, the two people, each plane, two people taken off, the first three planes, two people were taken off, two flight attendants, two passengers, and then one of each. The last plane, Flight 93, Let's Roll, that's a whole new we might do a two-hour show on that. There's so much stuff in that one. The last one, all of the handlers that were handling the other three planes were available. I think they had 11 phone callers on that one. Unfortunately, they're trying to tell us that most of them were calling all at once from the air phone. And again, in a rapid descent, they've been fighting G-forces to the point where they probably couldn't even hold a phone. And again, people like Jeremy Glick, judo champion, sitting there in Flight 93, talking to his wife through this whole massive rapid descent for about 20 minutes, never mentions a descent. Ooh, I bet he wasn't on the plane. Because let me tell you something, because I've been through this a few times. It's scary for a seasoned flight attendant to have to do an emergency descent at 6 to 10,000 feet a minute.
Scary for the pilot.
It's scary for everyone, and passengers usually scream. Nobody's sitting there. And the thing that's interesting, too, on Flight 93, just like on Flight 175, Brian Sweeney's mom said she didn't hear any background noise. Everyone on Flight 93 said, it was very strange. I didn't hear any background noise. I didn't hear any jets. I didn't hear any screaming or anything, any panic by anyone. It was as if they were calling from the room next door. And it was as if they were probably calling from an office in a hangar on the ground, from a landline, because that's the only way you could make these phone calls. So So if Brian Sweeney called from his cell, he was standing on the ground somewhere in western Massachusetts because we saw his plane landing. Now, the cool thing about this is the lady that did give me that, she put that in a legal affidavit and it's notarized and she is willing to go to court. I love that because the really cool Americans are standing up and starting to see things. And yes, we did not long ago have another eyewitness from western Massachusetts again seeing an all-silver 757, American Airlines Flight 77, headed right for the same place. So, obviously,
At the perfect time.
At the perfect timing. And so, when I put together all of the Freedom of Information Act data that I have, I found where the planes were supposed to be, where they claimed the FAA, the NORAD, and the U.S. Air Force claimed these planes were the altitude and where they were. And there's just no way that these two gentlemen, well-traveled, one of them a pilot, and one of them that could kill any human with his bare hands, 6'2", 225 pounds, trained in survival and U.S. Navy pilot, no way would he sit on the phone calls mommy in reality. And everyone knows that if you stop and think, it makes sense. And all of a sudden, what happens when you start to look at this, and this is what happened to me, layer by layer. And when I went back and looked at Flight 175, I went, oh, no. Because really, I thought, oh, my God, how sad. This guy, he flew F-14s in the 91 Gulf War. I remember that because I got all those shots and was flying MAC charters and all of that stuff. I kind of know what they went to. So when I started to see things like the Gulf War syndrome, I'm like, yike. I only didn't take a couple of those shots and fortunately for me, those were the two shots that I think that caused a lot of problems for a lot of those guys. But I was, you know, actively flying, and when I first read that, I thought, well, how sad is this? Here he puts his life on the line in this Gulf War, and he comes back, and he gets killed by these 5'6" Arabs in a commercial plane. Well, no. And I started to look at this with real, once I discovered other things, and I went back and clearly looked. This guy, these two callers, coincidentally, coinkydink, here comes the coinkydink, are both employed by two of the largest military industrial complex corporations, military contractors in the United States. What are the chances? Because guess what happened? After 9/11, we went to war, and we went to another war, and went to another war. I think Wesley Clark said there were seven of them planned for 5 years that they saw right before 9/11. We know PNEC. We know the Project for New American Century. They called for seven pre-planned wars prior to 9/11 happening, didn't they? So when we start to put all of the pieces of the puzzle together, you just feel like you've been hoodwinked, as Max Hager would say. You just start to feel angry, upset. And people, sometimes they get angry at me. I don't care. I'm just telling you what I found. You can go find what you want, but you can find just about anything because there's so many renditions. Keep in mind that some of the wives that had no idea, Todd Beamer's wife wrote a book. She wasn't even on the phone to him. He called the GTE operator because he was afraid she could tell he was lying, probably. Because an interesting thing about Todd Beamer, his cell phone, never mind, this is the Shanksville ditch that nothing survived, not even any landing gear, no titanium engine parts, nothing. But Todd Beamer's cell phone magically continued to make phone calls for, hours. Until, 6 hours, I think it was. A long time after the ditch was supposedly formed in Shanksville. So when you start to put all the stuff together, and there's a lot of stuff from Flight 93 and the people who made the phone calls and the people that were there and what they did and what they didn't do. But keep in mind, for a flight attendant, we would never allow you as a passenger to get up and help us in a hijacking. Because a hijacker usually has a weapon, and you don't know the steps to get the plane brought down. You don't know the code words we're going to tell the pilot. You can't talk to us because you don't know our language. You're not insured, and our company would never allow us to allow you to get up and play hero. Because what if you peed the bed in the middle of the crisis? Well, then we'd be in trouble. So we will never let you do that. And most people on the ground, they don't know that. And so when you bought that Let's Roll story with Todd Beamer, you didn't know what I'm telling you right now. Impossible. But for some reason, Brian Sweeney knew that this was a possibility on Flight 175, right there, 3 minutes before supposed impact.
You know, one of the things that I'm waiting for is that these airplanes that didn't go where they were said they went in the official story obviously have been put back into circulation some way, either
somehow
as a tanker or something else. I'm waiting for the serial numbers to show up someplace to prove that those planes are still in existence, maybe in a boneyard someplace, who knows.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting because I kind of looked into that because I know that every part, our coffee makers, our, the doors to the lavatories, the cockpit door, everything is stamped with a serial number, and a lot of the information on there is actually to the aircraft tail number. And so Boeing, when they build an aircraft, and they, I don't care what they put in there, they put the coffee maker in there, that serial number for that coffee maker goes in the book. And every single part on every single Boeing is in their book. I'm under the understanding that Boeing has never released that information for all four of the aircraft. They were all Boeing. And so how would we know if a tanker crashes? It's a KC-135. Is that what they call the 757 tankers? They use them commonly for refueling tankers. But we have just a couple minutes. And remember, I want to remind you, if you've missed this in some of the interviews, that the gentleman that was the comptroller, the banker for the United States Pentagon at the time, Rabbi Dov Zakheim, who was under investigation for misplacing $2.3 trillion by Donald Rumsfeld that he announced the day before on September 10, 2001, that the investigation was going on looking for where could this money have been misplaced to. He also was part of a consortium, a group of businessmen, who refurbished Boeing 767s and turned them in, commercial planes, and turned them into military refueling tankers and sold them around the world. Of course, being the comptroller of the Pentagon would certainly help him have those contacts.
He also was involved with the flight termination system.
He also
imagine
owned,
that, coinkydink.
Also owned the coinkydink. He was the CEO of SPC, Sam Paul Charlie, SPC Corporation, that made the flight termination system to this day, still operating our drones around the world, and was the remote control landing system both United and American had on board. Now, he had one other company, TriData, which was a subsidiary of SPC Corporation. After the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, they got huge contracts for doing the repair work on the Twin Towers, and that company, TriData, owned by the comptroller of the United States Pentagon, Rabbi Dov Zakheim, who later went to work for Booz Allen Hamilton, had the blueprints for both towers. What are the chances? Zero. You keep showing me zero when I ask you, what are the chances? So, I hope that you can understand that as a flight attendant, going through the details that I did with the attitude, the altitude, what was going on board, what the flight attendants were doing, you have to ask yourself, too, there were, you know, 7, 8, or 9 flight attendants on these wide-body aircraft. I think one had 9, one had 11, if I remember correctly. If two passengers called in, why didn't any flight attendants call in when Flight 11, only 2 flight attendants called in? They were on the phone for half an hour. Breaking protocol. You were to sit down and not draw attention to yourself unless you were dealing directly with the hijacker. Not sit on the phone. I mean, that's a great way to get a bullet in your head.
Well, even better yet, if the flight attendants weren't calling anybody, why didn't they contact the pilots who would have then squawked 7,500?
That's true.
And, of course, we know that they didn't squawk 7,500. So what were the flight attendants doing?
Yeah, because if they just stabbed one, like Peter Hansen said, they stabbed one airline hostess, he called her, what happened to the rest of the flight attendants? Well, I guess we're not supposed to know this, right? But it looks like we're running out of time. Thanks for joining us. I hope you've enjoyed this. We're going to keep it going.
Well, we gave Frank Sinatra the night off.
Okay, so we can talk down here for
he's not going to be
30 seconds longer.
I can't drag him away from the bar.
But YouTube hates him anyway, I have to cut him out.
And so, you know, that's the way it goes. Okay. So we've got like 30 seconds where we can
say
we're excited to talk about next week. We're going to talk about Flight
77.
Flew into the Pentagon, and just who knows what else might just crop up.
Yeah, that's true. So hopefully, if you have any questions, get a hold of me on email or through Facebook, my group page or my author like page or my personal page if you're a personal Facebook friend. And just let me know, and we'll try to get those addressed for you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.